We're going to now begin, you could say, the heart of OChem for this quarter. What we've been doing up to this point is building up some frameworks to discuss chemical reactions. So that's why we've been covering things like thermodynamics, kinetics, equilibrium, and mechanism. And then just squeezed into a couple of minutes last week, we finally talked about a series of concepts, things to worry about for particular chemical reactions. There were six of them that I had mentioned, and I want to just review that because we're going to tackle our first real reaction today, which is free radical halogenation. And we're going to discuss this reaction. I want to do that within this framework that I'm going to lay out. So free radical halogenation is a reaction that allows you to convert a plain old alkane into an alkyl halide. And when I gave these six different things that we worry about in a reaction, the first one of them was the synthetic utility. What's the use of that reaction? For this reaction, it would be to convert an alkane to an alkyl halide. Each of the different reactions that we're going to learn this quarter generally has a characteristic reagent or set of reagents. And so the reagents that could be used in this reaction are either diatomic chlorine or diatomic bromine. Oh gosh, sorry. So reagents. Conditions. Sometimes reactions have to be done under certain specific conditions like certain temperatures, maybe even a sequence of temperature changes. And in free radical halogenation, that's generally done in light. And often light is abbreviated using the same symbol to represent the energy of a photon. And generally, if you're using this symbol, you're implying not just that it's light, but it's UV light. Why? Because that happens to be right in the right energy range to cause compounds like chlorine and bromine to dissociate. One of the main features of a reaction that we're going to learn, and we're going to talk about this extensively for this reaction today, is mechanism. And by knowing the mechanism, we can then talk about what are the stereochemical consequences of the reaction. And even more, in this case, we're going to talk about the regiochemical consequences. The fact that there can be a whole multitude of products that are formed, and we need to discuss, well, which one's going to be the more likely one. So for each reaction we're going to learn, we're going to hit these six items. And I think I'd already suggested making flashcards for these reactions, because this is just one reaction that we're going to learn today, but there's at least a dozen others that we're going to learn this quarter. And then next quarter and the quarter after that, there'll just be more and more and more reactions that we pile on top. There is some level of memorization that's needed. You need to know what is the outcome of the reaction, what are these different classes of reagents, but the more you review these flashcards, hopefully you'll see similarities in their mechanism. But just as I got in my soapbox earlier this quarter and said that I've done OChem enough that I know what's going to happen at different points in the quarter, just believe me when I say that, you really, really should start making your flashcards. So when you make a flashcard, what I suggest is the mechanism I'm going to show you, put that on one side. Because usually what people struggle with the most is learning the mechanism. Usually if you can get the mechanism, even if you forget things like stereochemistry, regiochemistry, if you know the mechanism, you could recreate what's going to happen, if you understand what's going on behind that mechanism. On the other side of the card, then, I would put the other five items, so everything else except the mechanism. And then, if you talk to former OChem students, a lot of them do have their bundle of flashcards. So start with this one and don't get behind, because again, we're going to start getting reaction after reaction after reaction. Now let's look at the mechanism for this free radical halogenation. It can be a really useful reaction because alkanes really aren't reactive generally. There's no good polarity difference on the molecule or on the bonds, and so there's no good place for other molecules to get a grip on, you could say. The way that this reaction starts is by either chlorine or bromine dissociating. And I'll start out with bromine as my example reactant. So in the presence of light, bromine can break homolytically, which if you remember when we talked about reaction mechanisms, we talked about single electron mechanisms and electron pair mechanisms. Everything we see today is going to be the exception for the quarter. It's going to be a single electron mechanism. So notice that I'm using the half arrows, which we haven't hardly used at all, other than that lecture on mechanisms. And because the bond contains two electrons, that means I'm going to need two arrows, since each arrow only shows where one electron goes. So I'll form two bromine radicals. The next step is for that bromine radical to then react with an alkane. And a good example molecule I'll use for that is 2-methylbutane. And let's just say that I'm going to show the removal, or what's called the abstraction, of this hydrogen from a tertiary position. So the bond again has two electrons, so I'm going to need two arrows coming from that bond. I'm going to draw one of them pointing towards the bromine. So it's going to imply that that electron with a hydrogen is going to connect to bromine, which means we're going to produce hydrogen bromide as a byproduct. And then we'll have an alkyl radical. That alkyl radical will then turn right around and react with another molecule of bromine. When it does that, we'll get our product, a haloalkane, and then we'll make a bromine radical, which is actually exactly the first thing that we started with to attack the alkane. So in fact, this process of free radical halogenation is classified as a chain reaction. Because once the reaction starts, as long as you don't run out of reagents, you keep generating the exact same reactive species, and so it keeps on reacting, forming over and over again. So chain reaction is a mechanism that repeats continuously until reagents run out. Since one of the products produced is itself a reactant. And in fact, let's put some names to the different phases of this mechanism. So the top step happens all by itself. That is known as the initiation step. The next two steps together, since it's the pair of them that repeats, and you keep the reaction going and going and going, the couple is called the propagation steps. And then there are one or more termination steps that can occur. Now, I used this term abstraction earlier, so let me just define that. In this case, the abstraction, oh, you can't see that, sorry, refers to the removal of a hydrogen. I want to just define that briefly because we're going to see it just a moment again in the termination steps. So, one of the possible termination steps is that two bromide radicals might happen to find each other again in solution. To remake Br2. Fortunately, that termination step leads to one of the reagents. So the reaction wouldn't necessarily end overall if this occurred, as long as there's still light being used to reform radicals. Another possible termination step would be if a bromide radical reacted with an alkyl radical. That would make the desired product, but the reaction, at least that branch of the reaction, would end because you haven't regenerated radicals. You made the product without making another radical because you combined radicals. So let me just make a note here. No radicals. Of course, if a bromide and an alkyl radical could react with each other, maybe an alkyl radical might happen to interact with another alkyl radical. That, of course, would be an unwanted reaction because you'd get a byproduct. One of the unfortunate things about radical reactions, though, is that it's very difficult to control. And there's one other common byproduct that could form. Where instead of two alkyl radicals combining, you could have one radical abstract a hydrogen from the other. If that was to occur, you'd make another radical, which, since in this case they're radicals that are right next door to each other, they could combine to make a pi bond. And so you end up with two products that have similar backbone, but one is a saturated, fully singly bound compound. The other one, you produce an alkene. That unequal distribution is called disproportionation, which I think I had shown an example of when we did the list of mechanisms a week or two ago. Now, for our purposes, we don't care which of these happen. It's just the fact that they all can happen. Since you have a molar equivalent, though, of your alkane and bromine, other than the regiochemical effect that we're going to talk about in a moment, there is a good chance you're going to get the alkyl halide product. However, it is possible that you might have one alkane that reacts twice. So it is kind of a messy reaction. But this is the sequence. Initiation, again, either chlorine or bromine splitting up. And we'll talk at the end why we don't use either fluorine or iodine. We have this two-step back-and-forth reaction of the halide making an alkyl radical and an alkyl radical reacting with the halogen to make another halide radical. And then we have one of several possible termination steps. So, questions about the mechanism? Well, then let's get into the regiochemical effect of this mechanism. Yes? Yes, because imagine this. If you have light hitting a sample of this reaction, you can have multiple molecules of bromine falling apart at once. Those individual radicals could start their own chains, chain reactions. Some may terminate if you're continuously bombarding it with light. Others are starting because you're making more bromide radical. So some are stopping and starting all during the reaction. Yes? I don't know if biologically this particular reaction could happen, but the idea that radicals can cause a host of unwanted reactions is certainly true, which is why taking things that are radical scavengers, vitamin C supposedly is a radical scavenger. It helps prevent these unwanted side reactions. I've never had biochemistry in my own self, so I can't give specific examples, just from the media I've heard. It's because it's more that you have an uncontrolled reaction. Not so much that it's a chain process, but that anything in some sense could happen. So I've shown one possible product in this reaction, but one topic we're going to get into in lab today is about this concept called chemical equivalency. When is it that two hydrogens, for example, on the same molecule could be called the same hydrogen? So if I had two methylbutane, and let's say for the moment I don't worry about stereochemistry, I don't worry about whether a stereocenter is generated or not. If I put aside that worry, how many unique products could be formed in this reaction? In fact, let me erase this, because instead of talking about bromine first, I want to talk about chlorine now. So same mechanism, same results, in terms of same type of product. But how many products would we get if only one chlorine reacted? Well, let me help you out. We have the tertiary center that I've already showed reacting. So there's one type of product. What other unique kind of product could we get if we just put a chlorine somewhere on this molecule? Okay, so we could put it here. Would I generate a different product if I put it on the bottom one versus the top? Yes? No? You've got the word test going through your head, don't you? Okay. No, you would not get a different product, because since both methyl groups are hooked up to the same position, and since from that junction point the rest of the molecule is identical, from the perspective of these two methyl groups, the two methyl groups are equivalent. But they're not the same as this other terminus of the molecule, because over here where I'm pointing to now, on the right-hand side, that's a CH3 group attached to a secondary carbon versus where we had initially, which those methyl groups are attached to a tertiary carbon. So the two ends are not the same as each other, even though they are both primary carbons. They're different primary carbons. If we ignore stereochemistry, then the only other product we're going to get is if we substitute at the secondary position. So four types of products. Which one is going to be the most likely one to form in this reaction? So our instinct might tell us that first molecule is going to react, because in the process of this reaction, we make a tertiary radical. Tertiary radicals are more favorable generally than secondary than primary. Same way that tertiary carbocations are more favorable than secondary than primary. At the moment, I can't comment any further about that, since you need to be discussing that yourselves in an hour or so. But after the exam, then we'll come back and examine the reasons why. But since we could say tertiary radicals are more favorable than secondary than primary, we can now make a very firm energetic comparison. Because let me pull this back down and let's examine again the first step of this reaction. We're going to do chloride. Chloride pulling off a hydrogen to make a radical. Well, if I have a primary versus secondary versus tertiary radical forming from the same molecule, that means on a reaction coordinate diagram, I'd be starting from the same energy level each time. In other words, if I start with this alkane and look at making either of the primaries versus a secondary radical versus a tertiary radical, with hydrogen chloride being the same byproduct each time and chloride being the same reactant each time, this is one of those cases where we can truly use the word stable. Now, let me tell a story without writing this part of it down. This comes from back when I took physical organic chemistry. Berkeley actually is possibly a slight bit unusual in its graduate program in that it emphasizes heavily research instead of coursework. So we didn't take a heck of a lot of courses. But the big one that we did take is this course on physical organic chemistry, which is where you take general chem or physical chem and bring it back into organic chemistry. You talk about bond association and energy and numbers, very mathematical course. One of the big things that the instructor harped on was this word stable. Because imagine this, let's say I had something like butane versus decane, something with 4 carbons versus something with 10 carbons. They're not the same molecule. So if you make a radical from butane versus making a radical from decane, you can't make a direct comparison between those processes because you're not comparing from the same starting point. Think of Hess's law, that energy and chemical reactions depend on just the reactant and just the product. When you have different reactants, how can you make a direct comparison? So even though we say things like tertiary carbocations are more stable than secondary, there's probably some case out there where the amount of energy to form a tertiary carbocation on one particular molecule might happen to be more energy than to make a secondary in some other case. So in that case, you'd have to say, well, the secondary is more stable because less energy was used to make it. But if within the same molecule, which is what we're doing here, we're comparing tertiary versus secondary versus primary, then you're referring back to one firm starting point. And so you really can compare the energy differences, and that's when you can really use the word stable. So since I can put all these things confidently on one energy diagram, I can then talk about the energy of the transition states. And this is going to bring up something that we have not discussed in class yet, although I think it was assigned in one of the readings already, something known as the Hammond postulate. Which the Hammond postulate says this: whichever of the reactants or products that a transition state is closer in energy to, the structure of that transition state will also more closely match either that product or reactant. For example, in this case, the alkane is higher in energy than the alkyl halides. For just this portion of the reaction of the chlorine abstracting a hydrogen, it's exothermic. Since the alkane is higher in energy than the alkyl radical that's formed, and the transition state is above either of those in energy, the transition state energy is going to be closer to the alkanes than the alkyl radicals. And so the structure of the transition state is going to look more like the reactant, in this case, than the product. So again, Hammond postulate says the structure of the transition state. Which, just in case I use this abbreviation again, remember that we can use this symbol called a double dagger, which that's not a sloppy not equal sign. It's a double dagger sign that represents transition state. The structure of the transition state more closely matches the structure of the product or reactant or intermediate. That is closest to the transition state in energy. And let me just write out that again, in this particular case of chloride radical reacting with an alkane to make HCl plus the radical, that's a process where the energy change is exothermic. Again, because that puts the alkane higher in energy, the transition state's going to look more like the alkane. That means for the three different possible reactions, there's not an enormous difference between the activation energies for these reactions. There is a difference, though. And maybe I'm exaggerating it in the way that I've drawn it, just so you can see the different activation energies. But we can see that the activation energy for making a primary radical is going to be larger than the activation energy for a second, which is larger than the activation energy for the third. And so consequentially, forming a tertiary radical is going to happen more quickly than a secondary, than a primary. We write some of this down. So in this case, the transition state more closely resembles the reactant. So there is not a huge difference in the activation energies for forming a primary versus secondary versus tertiary radical. As a consequence of this, there is a generalized relative reactivity. Of the halide to primary, secondary, and tertiary halogens. And it turns out that ratio, if you round the numbers, is 1:4:5. So that means that the tertiary radical is 5 times more likely to form, which means that you're going to get 5 times greater amount of tertiary product per hydrogen than you would for primary. Now, before I wrap this part of it up, let me ask if there's questions about the reaction coordinate diagram or what I just said about the tertiaries forming more quickly. Yes.
Particularly if you put
an excess of chlorine in, you could get over-halogenation.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to the set of products.
In fact, to give ourselves a little more room, let me rewrite them.
Because now, given what we just discussed, let me ask again. Which of these four products should be the most likely one, statistically? Well, you might be tempted to say yes. This one? So, this isn't the most likely one, but you hit on another important aspect of this reaction, which is these relative reactivities, 1 to 4 to 5, those are relative reactivities per hydrogen. But how many total hydrogens would look like the one that got substituted here? How many hydrogens are there at the two methyl groups combined? 6 hydrogens.
So I know this is not a percentage, we're making a ratio. But if we take the fact that there's 6 hydrogens and we multiply it by its relative reactivity of 1, then on a ratio basis, we'll make 6 molecules of this particular product. Let's look at the other primary product and see, well, there's only 3 of that same kind of hydrogen there. It would have the same reactivity, basically, as the other primary position. So if you form 6 of the second product, you'd only form 3 of the third one. Now, what about the first one, though, the more reactive tertiary center?
It may be more reactive, but there's only 1 hydrogen at that place. So even though it's 5 times more likely to react, that means it's going to be a minor product compared to the primary position. Look at the last product, then. It has 2 hydrogens at that position. Again, ignoring stereochemistry would give us the same product. Secondaries are 4 times as reactive as primaries, and so in a ratio basis, you'd get 8 of this molecule, which means this is statistically the product formed in greatest quantity. So this is, yes.
So each methyl group here is 3 hydrogens. You got 2 methyl groups, so 2 times 3 is 6.
Over here, you only have 1 hydrogen since you already got 3 carbon-carbon bonds. On this one, it's just a methyl group, so again, just 3 hydrogens. And then since this is a secondary position, you have to remember we're talking about it before the chlorine's on there. So there's 2 hydrogens that could react at that position. That's where I get the 2H from. So this is the regiochemical consequence of this reaction. You know, out of that list of 6 things, this is one of them. That the most likely product depends on both the reactivity of the hydrogen and statistically how many hydrogens are present. On top of that, we're going to have every possible monohalogenated product formed, along with some side reactions where you could get multiple halogenation. But let's focus just on the monohalogenation.
So every possible monohalogenated product would form. And the most likely product depends on the reactivity of the hydrogen along with how many hydrogens are present. Now, this is for chlorine. Let's go back now and look at bromine, since we started with it and then retreated from it. Okay, so turns out the relative reactivity of bromide towards a primary, secondary, or tertiary alkane position, if you round the numbers off, it ends up being 1:80, 1600. So quite a bit more selectivity. Far more likely to get the tertiary product out. Why is this so? It turns out it's because the first step of that propagation reaction, that portion of the mechanism where bromide would abstract a hydrogen, that step is endothermic. Well, what does that mean as far as the reaction coordinate diagram that we would draw in this case? Well, similar to what we did before, but of course with one big difference. The reactants would now lie lower in energy than any of the radicals formed. Again, from the Hammond postulate, we would say that the energy of the transition state more closely matches the energy of the product or reactant it is closer in energy to. Since the radicals are higher in energy than the reactant, then the transition states will all look more like the radicals. So those energies are going to be closer to the radicals. That causes a much bigger difference between the activation energies for these three possible outcomes. So again, on the first diagram I drew, it might be misleading, because it looks like there's a fair bit of difference there. The text actually quotes the numerical values for those activation energies. And if you look at them for this process of forming the radical from bromide, they're much bigger gaps than for chloride. So since the transition state in this step more closely resembles the product, there is a greater difference in the activation energies for forming a primary versus secondary versus tertiary radical. So now let's look at the product distribution again, just like we did for the chloride.
It's the same example, alkane reacting with bromine now and light will form the same four types of monohalogenated products. Tertiary, secondary, and the two different primaries. We again would have one hydrogen versus two hydrogens versus three versus six. Times now the relative reactivities of 1600 versus 80 versus 1. That would give us a ratio of 1600 to 160 to 3 to 6
for these different products. So you'd still get a significant quantity of the secondary product, but far greater amount of the tertiary. So if it's possible to be used, bromide is usually chosen instead of chlorine in this kind of radical reaction. The overall process is not as energetically favorable with bromine, so overall it is a slower reaction.
So when possible, bromine is used instead of chlorine. Due to bromine's greater selectivity.
Chlorination is most frequently used in molecules that have some form of symmetry. And so, where there's maybe only one possible product that is formed.
The example that your text gives is the chlorination of cyclohexane.
If you only have monohalogenation, it doesn't really matter if you're attacking an equatorial versus axial hydrogen. You're going to get the same product.
And since all the carbons are equivalent, ignoring byproducts from polyhalogenation,
you're only going to get one major product. Yes?
So when you're saying based on a particular halogen is used, this is because the disproportionate one of the tertiary carbon being attacked by the bromine is so strong. Is it 1600? Is it percent? What was the amount?
Relative rate of reaction. So the tertiary would react 1600 times faster than the secondary, than, or sorry, 1600 times faster than the primary. And the secondary is 80 times faster than the primary.
But you still have all those other side products in somehow. If you decided to use that
to
remove the
natural
product, you still have all that other side stuff.
You'll still have those, yes.
But it's not as much the same with the
chlorine. Right, exactly. And you would hopefully then have a good step of separation afterwards. If this was being done on an industrial scale, my guess would be there would be some kind of distillation tower that would separate out the different products. I don't know if it would be easier or not, but it might be more successful since there's already that great difference. Now, we need to come back to mention, why is fluorine not used in this reaction? Why is iodine not used in this reaction? So, iodide is not used because the overall reaction is endothermic. So if I tried to represent it by this way, the magnitude
of the heat of reaction when using fluorine is much greater than the magnitude for chlorine. It's much greater than the magnitude for bromine. All of these are endothermic processes. So the larger the magnitude, that means the more favorable the reaction is. In fact, let me highlight this and say that the energy released by fluorination is a lot greater. Now, I know I was just about to mention iodine, but since I put this comparison down, let me say fluorine is generally not used because it's so reactive that there's very little differentiation between primary, secondary, and tertiary. So the reaction with fluorine is so exothermic that there is almost no difference in the activation energies for forming different radicals. So in fact, for primary versus secondary versus tertiary, that ratio is 1 to 1.2 to 1.4. So it essentially means the more hydrogens there are, the more of that product there'll be, regardless of its primary, secondary, or tertiary. Then back to iodine now. Iodine its reaction is endothermic, which means that the reverse reaction of getting rid of iodine is more favorable. So in fact, if you try to do this reaction, you form alkyl iodides. Those alkyl iodides under light would just decompose. And you can see evidence of alkyl iodides decomposing by solutions containing them turning yellow. So halogenation using iodine is not possible. Since the reaction is endothermic. Again, that means that the alkyl iodides would decompose under light. So now when you go to read this section, there might be a little bit beyond this reaction that's in there. It's either this or in one other chapter that the formation reaction of allyl radicals is mentioned. But since we haven't tackled alkenes yet, we're going to skip that for now. And then there is one other reaction this quarter that involves radicals, which is going to involve alkynes. So since we haven't even gotten to alkenes yet, we'll skip over that for now. So you need to focus at the moment just on this free radical halogenation. Questions on this reaction now? Any aspect of the reaction? All right, so we will have the second round of our exam during lab, and we'll start with that just so we can get it out of the way. So I do have office hours now, but do realize I need to be a bit sensitive about what kinds of questions I answer since you haven't quite finished your exam yet. Yes?
How much time do you have?
30 minutes. That's what the other two sections got.
Okay.